Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is going to sound weird coming from a business program and all, but sometimes the numbers don't tell you everything. Yeah, you got to look at them. Other times, though, you just have to go with your guts, even when the numbers punch you right there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org/value.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Friday. It is the 4th of April today, and I don't know that any economists would actually admit this if you asked them, but they do a certain amount of winging it when they're trying to figure out what's going on. Take, just for one example, today's March unemployment figures. Objectively, 80,000 jobs lost isn't a huge number. But when it's the biggest monthly drop in 5 years, as it was, and it's the third consecutive month of declines, as it was, then it's not so good. For those of you who've been debating whether or not we're in a recession, it might be time to move on to another question now. How bad's it going to be? Marketplace's Elisa Roth went looking for some answers.
There's no question these are some big numbers. And not surprisingly, some sectors were hit worse than others, construction and financial services, to name two. But the numbers are bigger than economists were predicting, which always causes a little anxiety, especially on Wall Street. But as one economist said to me today, 95% of the workforce in the U.S. is still on the job. The real question, says economist Hugh Johnson, is how long and how deep this slowdown, whatever you want to call it, is going to last. And he believes
there's a reasonable case it could be made that this is not going to be long and it's not going to be severe.
Expect another quarter of lousy jobs numbers and other data. But after that, he says, things should start looking up.
We've gotten some messages from the financial markets recently that give us the reason to believe that conclusion. So I don't think all is lost.
Johnson's convinced the Fed's efforts to unclog the credit markets will work and that pretty soon we'll all be back to business as usual. Ken Goldstein is an economist at the Conference Board. He says consumers are too worried to go back to business as usual, and it's not losing their jobs they're afraid of.
Consumers are looking at what's coming in and nervous a little bit about that, looking about what we have to pay and nervous about how much more that's going to be, so that household budgets are being squeezed as we speak.
And that, he says, would be true even if the economy had gained 80,000 jobs last month instead of losing them. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Mortgage industry reform and a Bear Stearns postmortem used up most of the oxygen on Capitol Hill this week. But come Monday, national security is going to be firmly back on the agenda. Today, Democratic leaders sent the president a letter asking for more withdrawals of U.S. troops from Iraq. They maintain the White House is costing the country hundreds of billions of dollars despite urgent needs here at home. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the letter is just the latest step in the fight over spending for the war on terror.
The Pentagon is preparing to ask Congress for another $102 billion to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through September. That five-month bill is on top of nearly $700 billion appropriated over the past 6 years. Most of the war's funding has come from so-called emergency supplemental bills outside the normal Defense Department budgets. This time, the Pentagon brass and members of Congress are planning to include spending for more general military operations, like a new fighter plane and military base construction in the U.S. Stephen Kosiak at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment says there are plenty of incentives to put these extra items in the war supplemental.
It is considered sort of must-pass legislation. It's for the troops. It doesn't get the same level of scrutiny as a regular defense appropriations bill does. It's considered emergency spending. It doesn't have the same political connotations in terms of adding to the deficit and things like that.
Despite opposition to the war, Congress is expected to okay the extra spending before Memorial Day. Democrats are considering limiting reconstruction aid to Iraq, arguing growing oil revenue means Iraqis can afford their own rebuilding. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Those shaky job numbers didn't shake investor confidence today. Of course, they didn't bump it up any either. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. I was trying to figure out the relationship the other day between the financial crisis everybody says we're in today and the financial crisis, the one that gives economists all the nightmares. And I found a book called Essays on the Great Depression by a guy named Ben Bernanke. I was thinking that since he's the one who approved the $29 billion bailout of Bear Stearns, it'd be good to understand what he knows about keeping economies out of depressions. Bernanke would be the first to tell you Wall Street's the wrong place to start if you want to analyze what really happened to the economy 75 years ago. Yes, $14 billion went out the window the day of the crash, but the Dow Industrials actually rose through the rest of 1929 and into the spring of 1930.
It's too easy to blame the Depression of the 30s on the stock market.
Richard Silla is a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at NYU.
What really happened was later in 1930, there were lots of bank failures in the fall and the beginning of winter.
In the next 3 years, 7,000 U.S. banks failed. The blame belongs squarely with the central banks, says business historian John Steele Gordon.
The Federal Reserve did nothing after the panic. I mean, it was fighting inflation when deflation had become the problem. It was, in effect, treating the patient for fever when the patient was freezing to death.
By the time Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated, one of every three banks in this country had been closed by state governments or had gone out of business entirely.
In March 4, 1933, things were about as bad as they could be in the United States.
Almost the first thing Roosevelt did when he got to the White House was close the rest of the banks. He explained why in his first fireside chat.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. To talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking, but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who use banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks.
This is where what happened back then gets us to where we are now. Roosevelt started the FDIC in 1933 to insure individual accounts, but we use banks today to do so much more than just make deposits and write checks. Berkeley economist Barry Eichengreen says the rules haven't changed enough since the New Deal to keep up.
In the 1930s, the problems were concentrated in the banking system and the commercial banks in particular. Now they're primarily in what people refer to as the shadow banking system, the investment banks and the hedge funds. But the names have changed. I think the underlying problem is the same.
Opinions split about whether or not Bernanke's Federal Reserve should have helped J.P. Morgan bail out Bear Stearns. There's not much disagreement, though, about what would have happened if it hadn't.
Bear Stearns would have suspended operations on the Monday, and by freezing other people's assets and collateral, which it held, questions would have arisen about the solvency and stability of other investment banks. And I think we could have seen the kind of financial market panic that has not occurred in the United States since the 1930s.
Now that Bear's been saved and we know the Fed's out there willing to step in, could a panic like the one that fueled the Great Depression happen again? NYU's Richard Silla says no, in part because of the guy who wrote that book that I mentioned.
Nobody learned more from the experience of the Depression of the 1930s than Ben Bernanke.
Ask around among economists and you'll get a fistful of different answers about how bad the current crisis really is. But they all say pretty much the same thing when you ask them where the next crisis is going to come from. Wall Street is full of really smart people.
They're always looking for new ways to earn money and new ways to create wealth and new ways to leverage, to use somebody else's money to make money.
Make money despite what Bernanke and the Fed might do and whether Congress and the Bush administration can agree on new regulations for the financial markets or not. We'll be right back. Here's a question to ask as you consider your impact on the environment. Is that Prius you're tooling around in all about reducing your carbon footprint? Or does a little part of you like the eco-cred you get from being seen driving a hybrid? Commentator Rob Walker wonders whether the days of status shopping might be over.
Thorsten Veblen introduced the idea of conspicuous consumption in his book The Theory of the Leisure Class in 1899, and it's still being recycled today. Veblen gave examples like the man who parades down Main Street in stainless linen with a superfluous walking stick. These objects supposedly projected evidence of leisure to an audience of strangers. Today's consumer is supposed to be a little more sophisticated than that, so it's puzzling how many marketers still talk about how a certain beer or sneaker or handbag functions as a so-called badge. Even hybrid cars are said to be eco-status markers that show conspicuous concern about the environment. More scholarly observers call this signaling, but in the end, it's all repackaged Veblen. We buy stuff mostly to impress other people. And maybe that used to be the case, but these days, buying stuff to impress other people just isn't practical. That's because Main Street today is a much more confusing place, crowded with niche consumer tribes. Some see status in sneakers, but others in handbags, and still others in eco-chic stuff, and who knows, maybe some see it in fancy walking sticks. The point is, there's not much consensus. Even a leading fashion expert recently confessed to a reporter he couldn't remember the last time he saw someone on the street and thought definitively, "Oh, you're hopelessly out of style." Everything is equal, is how he summed it up, and when a top trend tracker concludes that keeping up with the Joneses is a waste of energy, it's probably time to admit that the whole concept is out of date. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be proud of your hybrid or your limited edition kicks or the latest It bag. Just don't expect strangers to be impressed. Conspicuous consumption is over. We're now in the age of the invisible badge.
Rob Walker writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. His book, Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are, will be published in June. If you're a sucker for a specific brand, tell us about it. Marketplace.org is our homepage. Click on the link that says Contact. Time to check the week on Wall Street. Not with David Johnson this time. He is away again. Kim Clark is in Washington, D.C. She's with U.S. News and World Report. Hi, Kim.
Hey, Kai. I have an old joke for you.
All right. Go ahead.
What's the difference between a recession and a depression?
I don't know.
Well, it's an old joke, but a recession is when
you're a young guy.
A recession is when your neighbor loses his job, and a depression is when you lose your job.
All right. Okay. Now, why are you telling me this?
Because on Tuesday, I think Wall Street realized we're entering into a recession and not a depression.
All right, I got it. Let's remind people what happened on Tuesday, right? That's the punchline.
Right. Okay. So a week ago, rumors started flying all over Wall Street that Lehman Brothers was in the same kind of trouble as Bear Stearns. I mean, there might have been actually another run on Lehman Brothers. Mm-hmm. But on Monday night, Tuesday morning, Lehman announces that it had raised $4 billion in funding so that everybody was, you know, reassured they didn't have to draw their money out. As a result, the Wall Streeters went on a party. You remember the Dow Jones went up several hundred points. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, no matter what bad news has happened, Wall Streeters have shrugged it off and said, well, you know.
Exactly. I mean, let's finish the story from Tuesday, right? Not only was it Lehman Brothers selling out, but that day, Tuesday, UBS announced a $19 billion write-down, right?
And what happened to UBS stock that day?
Yeah, I don't know. It probably went
up. It went up.
Right. The Dow was up 391 points that day. But here's what I want to know from you. You ready?
Yeah.
So we are now three days past Tuesday, right? Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And the Dow basically is where it was. We haven't given any of that back. And I thought for sure Wednesday or Thursday we were going to sell it out.
Not only that, today we had a very bad jobs report. We had 80,000 fewer jobs this month than we have the month before. You have unemployment rising to 5.1%. You'd think that'd be bad news. But no, actually, as you mentioned, the Dow and the S&P are pretty much flat.
All right, so do you think...
Flat is the new up.
Flat is the new up. I like that. I'm actually going to use that. Do you think that Wall Street knows something we don't know?
Well, the theory has always been that Wall Street looks 6 months ahead. So if things are sort of firming up on the investment markets, that means that they're betting that 6 months from now, the Main Street economy is actually going to start firming up. So maybe that's a good sign for everybody.
All right, but I'm going to pull out Ben Bernanke, who I like to go to in times of trouble. I'm going to point you to his testimony on the Hill this week in which he said a recession is possible.
Right, that's true, but maybe what Wall Street is saying is it's going to be over or things are going to be turning around within 6 months.
All right, well, we shall see what we shall see. Kim Clark from U.S. News and World Report. Thank you, Kim.
You bet, Kai.
Coming up, convincing the congregation to go to the movies.
Hollywood's been really trying to replicate this model. And they have failed over and over again.
But first, let's do the numbers. Jitters over jobs jinxed an otherwise buoyant week for Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost some ground, ending the day 16 points lower, a tenth of 1%, 12,609 for the blue chips. The Nasdaq went in the other direction, closed up 7 points, a third of 1%, 2370 at the bell. The S&P 500 nudged up fractionally, just a single point to wrap up trading at 1370. For the week gone by, the Dow climbed 2.3%, 3.2% rather. The Nasdaq had its best week since August of 2006, rising 4.8%. The S&P 500 turned in its best weekly performance in a couple of months with a gain of 4.2% since Monday. A rebound by pharmaceutical stocks helped support the market today. Schering Plowshares rallied 4.8%. Merck recovered 4.25%. Investors are back to frowning over financials, though. Wachovia Corp shares dropped more than 4% today. JPMorgan Chase sank 1.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board reports on consumer credit for February. Winners of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize are announced in New York, and it's World Health Day. This year's theme focuses on health and climate change. According to the World Health Organization, about 600,000 people died worldwide as a result of weather-related disasters in the 90s. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a reason that authors get some of their money from book contracts up front, and why publishers let retailers return copies that have gotten stuck on bookstore shelves. Truth is, most books don't really sell very well. But a new division of HarperCollins is trying to turn the old model inside out. Jeremy Hobson reports now on a new chapter in a struggling industry.
HarperCollins CEO Jane Friedman says old traditions are tying down the industry while the marketplace moves forward. Traditions like allowing booksellers to return unsold books.
It started during the Depression when publishers wanted to get their books into stores and retailers wouldn't take them unless they knew that they had no risk. And somehow it has never evolved into something else. It is ununderstandable.
Equally frustrating, Friedman says, is paying big cash advances to authors whose books end up losing money. The new model would scrap the advance and give the author a bigger share of the profits.
The truth is that in this model, an author can make more money if the book works.
I think it's got a lot of upside for the publisher and a lot of downside for the author.
Lori Liss is a partner with the literary agency Sterling Lord.
You know, what's the difference between that and self-publishing?
Robert Miller, who started Disney's adult publishing division, will oversee HarperCollins' new unit. He plans to produce audio and e-book versions of every title. Liss says if anyone can start a revolution, it's him.
That would be nice. We could use a revolution in publishing right about now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The world's most popular business newspaper goes on sale in the UK later this month. The U.S. edition of the Wall Street Journal is going to be printed and sold in London for the first time. Europe's had its own version of the paper for about 25 years, but the prospect of the American edition showing up is different. It's being seen as a predatory move by the journal's new boss, a guy named Rupert Murdoch. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on the opening salvo of a new circulation war.
Morning. Can I have a Financial Times, please?
It's £1.50.
Every working day, fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart religiously picks up a copy of the Financial Times. So do more than 100,000 other workers here in the so-called Square Mile, the heart of London's financial district.
The Financial Times isn't the normal commercial paper. It's actually part of our industry. If you're actually going to be in the Square Mile, you're going to have the Financial Times. It's part of our language. Everybody will have the FT.
Part Bible, part parish magazine it may be, but nothing sacred in newspaper publishing. The FT's dominance here could soon be under attack from the world's best-selling financial paper.
Well, we're really excited about launching the US edition of the Wall Street Journal in London.
Tim Lafferty, European Sales Director for Dow Jones. He says the US version of the journal should prove highly popular in London, especially this year.
With the credit crisis, which will continue to roll, but also, of course, the US elections in November. You know, I don't think there's anyone that is going to cover that story better than the Wall Street Journal.
Is this an attack on the Financial Times in its heartland?
Absolutely not. This is just about offering readers choice.
The FT, usually eager to offer an opinion about everyone else's business, does not wish to comment. But the paper, whose motto is without fear, without favour, should be shaking in its shoes, says media analyst Chris Horry. Murdoch is gunning for the FT.
He will attack their distribution, he will attack their revenue streams, he will attack their advertising. And they need to hunker down for a very serious battle.
Horry says the FT is one of the journal's most serious rivals in the global market for business information, in print and online.
War has been declared on a global basis as to which will be the premier reliable brand for business news and information in the 21st century. That's an enormous prize.
He says undermining the FT on its home turf is part of that strategy. A senior executive in Murdoch's parent company has been quoted saying, "We will crush the Financial Times." In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Horton Hears a Who is heading into its fourth weekend in theaters today. The Dr. Seuss story still has the year's biggest opening so far. A couple of years ago, a far less gentle film, Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, did pretty well for itself, despite all the big Hollywood studios taking a pass. They probably figured an R-rated movie in Aramaic about the death of Jesus wouldn't sell. I don't know. They got that one wrong. It eventually became one of the highest-grossing films ever. And some producers are now hoping Christian audiences will be just as passionate about a new film opening next weekend. It's a documentary about intelligent design. That's the idea that living things are the work of one intelligent creator. And they hope it's going to do for the creation versus evolution debate what Mel did for the crucifixion. Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
How do you make a blockbuster out of a documentary about politics in academia? That was the question facing the producers of Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. The film focuses on a group of university professors who say they were fired for dissing Darwin.
If you have questioned Darwinism, that's it. Your career is over.
Scientists are not allowed to even think thoughts that involve an intelligent creator.
Thoughts like a higher being created the universe, and there's nothing natural about natural selection. Controversial, yes, but the stuff blockbusters are made of? After all, Darwin doesn't exactly have the mass appeal of Batman, and Expelled star Ben Stein has a latte-drinking, op-ed-reading kind of following, but may lack the box office pull of, say, Jesus. Still, executive producer Walt Ruloff insists there are no small films, only small marketing efforts.
As business people, we said, okay, where can we get some real traction with this?
Ruloff knew exactly where, the faith-based community. Expelled argues that academia persecutes people who talk seriously about intelligent design. That's a message that could resonate with religious groups, the same groups that helped Passion of the Christ bank more than $500 million at the box office. But Ruloff says it's a tough crowd. He points out films like Constantine and The Nativity Story tried to ride passion's coattails and couldn't pull it off.
Hollywood's been really trying to replicate this model, and they have failed over and over again.
Expelled is spending millions to succeed, huge for a documentary. It's hired four PR firms. It's running a sweepstakes for church groups, offering a cash prize to the one that sells the most tickets. It's paying up to $10,000 for schools to send their students. The movie even staged a songwriting competition. If you challenge evolution, you'll get expelled. If you dare to say it's foolish. Oh, and Ben Stein traveled across the country on a bright red bus for Expelled the Roadshow. This is mostly the work of Motive Marketing's Paul Lauer. He's the guy who made passion into a phenomenon by harnessing the power of this country's 160 million Christians.
How do you get this big amoeba to flex its muscle? When it flexes, it's enormous. The challenge has always been, how do you get those people to activate?
Not the traditional Hollywood way. Lauer went directly to leaders in religious communities and showed them Expelled. He provided them with reading materials and videos that drive home intelligent design's creationist philosophy, the hope to inspire lessons and ticket sales.
You're transmitting to them as a little mini tower, and they in turn transmit to all the people around them.
One such transmitter is Daryl Bach, a professor of New Testament studies at the Dallas Theological Seminary and a kind of evangelical marketing guru for Hollywood. Bach says he was eager to promote Expelled.
Yesterday morning, I showed a trailer of the film, talked about why it was important to the university community, etc.
Bach believes the faith-based market will embrace Expelled. But Steve Bloom, who has financed movies like Platoon and Hoosiers, isn't so sure. He says marketing savvy alone won't guarantee another passion.
It's a one-off success because it was fresh and new and different. And just because that one worked doesn't mean it's opened up a whole new genre.
But Professor Bach says the market is there. It's just that Hollywood doesn't understand it. He says a lot of faith-based flops, like Evan Almighty, didn't have anything serious to say to Christians.
And I'm not sure Hollywood has yet come to grips with what makes a faith-based community and why they might be interested in more substantive pieces.
Hollywood will come to grips with Expelled on April 18th when it opens in theaters. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace. If you challenge evolution, you'll get expelled. If you dare to say it's foolish, you'll get expelled. If you follow where the clues lead, you'll get expelled. Because they don't want people to think, you'll get expelled.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note as we wrap up the week, it's tax time for Senator Hillary Clinton and the former president. The rest of us, too. We just don't have to make our tax returns public. The Clintons made more than $109 million over the past 7 years. They paid a total of $33.8 million in taxes. That's a rate of about 31%. 10% or so went to charity. Their main sources of income were the former president's speeches and book sales for the both of them. The Clinton campaign released the returns late this afternoon. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow tumbled 16 points, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 eked out a point. That's a fraction of a single percentage point. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, tips for finding a job when your resume is a rap sheet.
What I will say, though, is if all you have is T-shirts and jeans and sneakers, cool. You know what I'm saying? Just come crispy at least. Come presentable, man.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.